Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with three lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Baseball season is heating up. Odyssey has you covered with the most entertaining coverage of your team. Stay locked in and in the know with the local voices you trust as they bring you unfiltered takes, recap games, react to the latest team news, and talk to callers. Listen to your favorite shows for free on the Odyssey app, odyssey.com, your smart speaker, or in the car with Android Auto or Apple CarPlay.
All right, so Rick Bigelow. He's our historian. He's one of his many specialties is the Far East and World War II. And last time we spoke, we said, you know what? MacArthur deserves a good analysis. And so Rick Bigelow's with us today. Rick, how are you?
Doing fine, Bob. Glad to be with you.
No. Well, we're happy to have you again to go a little bit more in depth on MacArthur himself, and we remind our listeners this hour brought to you by Road Scholar Transport. Rick, start us off where we start to get to know MacArthur, 1941.
Okay, so in 1941, he was recalled to the American Army by FDR, and he initially put him in charge of what was known as the Southwest Pacific areas, which would be the Philippines and Australia and New Guinea and so on and so forth. And then, I mean, we all kind of know that basically the Japanese attacked and pretty much took over all of the Philippines. MacArthur moved his headquarters to Corregidor in Manila Bay. And eventually, it was clear that the Japanese were going to take all of the Philippines. So FDR ordered MacArthur to get out, and he was taken by PT boats down to Mindanao, and then he flew to Australia. And he thought he was going to take over a huge American army in Australia and go back to the Philippines. But when he got there, he discovered there was no huge army. So he knew it was going to take him a while to get back to the Philippines. In 42, he started the campaign in New Guinea. That was a tough slog in New Guinea, and that deserves to be talked about in more detail at some point in time.
We should do that, yes. Because it's called the War at the End of the World.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's a good 12,000 miles from the east coast of the United States, and of course, if you're in Australia, it's right next door, but. But for us, it was just out of sight, out of mind for the most part.
By the way, to interrupt with current news, the Biden, I don't want you to get involved in this, but the Biden lie about his uncle being eaten by cannibals on Papua New Guinea brought me to recall not only the Frank Sinatra song we do at quarter to noon, but that's just an aside. I won't be able to think of Papua New Guinea without without thinking of that story. But the leader of Papua New Guinea says, "You painted us with a very broad brush, Mr. President." Anyway, campaign in New Guinea. October 16th, tell us what happens.
So October 16th, a huge armada, 700 ships, 150,000 troops, wow, leaves New Guinea to invade the Philippines. They land at Leyte Gulf, and it's a tough slog up through Leyte and and then eventually into Lingen Golf in Luzon. And, you know, MacArthur's, he's successful, but it's much tougher than he thought it would be. And then taking Manila eventually was just a horrible slaughter. And you know, there something like a million Filipinos died during the Japanese occupation and the campaign to retake the Philippines. So then the atomic bombs are dropped. And frankly, MacArthur didn't know anything about the atomic bombs until just a few days before they were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and Nimitz didn't know either.
And so, what's interesting, though, Rick Bigelow, that they didn't know about it, but it was an open secret stateside.
About the atomic bomb?
Yes.
I don't really know that it was.
Well, they had to stop newspapers, you know, they had to stop newspapers from publishing about it. And I mean, so many people knew something big was going on in New Mexico and all that.
Right. But they didn't know exactly what it was.
Yeah.
And but, you know, Stalin knew. Stalin knew all about it. So the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Yeah, honestly.
So, I mean, MacArthur was supposed to be the overall commander of the invasion of the Japanese home islands. And I think he felt kind of cheated by the atomic bombs because he wanted to go down in history as the greatest commander of the greatest military invasion ever. Uh-huh. But anyway, so
that huge Harry ego Truman, never is always at the surface or near the surface at the very least in MacArthur exploits. That's for sure.
Absolutely. So Harry Truman names him to be essentially the military governor of Japan after the war ends. So September 15th, we get the surrender in Tokyo Bay. And there are 300 American and British ships in Tokyo Bay. And there's another huge task force off the islands just in case. And we have the surrender. And MacArthur turns to Halsey and says, "Start him up, Bill." And the next thing you know, 1,500 American and British planes overfly the event. And later, one Japanese admiral said, "We must have been crazy to think we could have beaten the Americans." So
that's what they call overwhelming force, right?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And we went from pretty much nothing at the end of 1941 to this overwhelming force. Plus, we were, you know, supplying the Russians and supplying the British and the French and putting our own troops into North Africa and Europe, too. So it was an amazing effort, that's for sure.
Yeah.
So he gets to Japan, and he had, and of course, none of this was pre-planned. I mean, the State Department was kind of working on, you know, what happens when Japan finally surrenders, maybe in 1947 or 48 or something like that. The atomic bomb changes everything, and Japan surrenders. So MacArthur came up with 11 priorities for the occupation of Japan. First of all, he knew it needed to be quick, because being a student of history, he knows that occupations never go well. And in fact, our occupation of the Philippines after the Spanish-American War took some pretty dicey turns, too. So he knew he wanted to get in, change the Japanese culture somewhat, and get the Americans out. He wanted to destroy the Japanese military, have representative government, enfranchise women, liberate the farmers, free labor movement, abolish the secret police, liberalize education, and so on and so forth. He was smart enough that he knew that he wanted to use the emperor to help reshape Japan. And he was faced with tremendous opposition here, because most of East Asia wanted to try the emperor and execute him, because he had brought all this upon East Asia, and it was in China and New Guinea and the Dutch East Indies and the Philippines. So he had to hold the wolves at bay. to that extent.
So MacArthur's he's taking over a country, though, that has just expended everything they have, men, munitions, resources. I mean, Japan's a mess.
It is a mess. Food and fuel, especially, are very short supply. Cities were destroyed. There were probably 5 million Japanese soldiers outside of Japan in Korea and China and the Philippines and the Dutch East Indies. Russia wanted to grab territory it lost in the 1904-1905 Russo-Japanese War. The British, French, and Dutch wanted to reclaim their colonies. And, of course, FDR was 100% opposed to that, but he wasn't in the picture anymore, and it wasn't clear what Harry Truman's thoughts on that were going to be. And the Asian nations wanted revenge big time. He also knew that women had no rights. There was tremendous inflation. Most of the land was owned by wealthy landowners, and he wanted to change that.
And also, Rick Bigelow, if you know, I mean, this was just not part of their culture that in Japan to have women participate in electoral politics and society in any other way than a subservient role.
Exactly. So he was looking at major changes in the culture, and his philosophy there was he wanted to make sure women could vote because women rarely vote for war. He said, you know, if the women can dissuade the militarists from starting wars again, that would be in everybody's best interests.
So also, it's sort of that's what you call irony, that a male centric view of women allowed them to overcome a male centric view of women.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So anyway, he was going to use the emperor, and because the Japanese still revered the emperor, whatever the emperor said to the Japanese people, 99.9% of them would go along with it. And he played the emperor pretty well. He never went to see the emperor. The emperor always came to see him.
That's where the big ego plays right. It played properly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He played it really well there. And I think that just showed the Japanese people that this guy MacArthur must be really special if our emperor is kind of kowtowing to him.
How tall was MacArthur, if you know?
Pardon me?
How tall was MacArthur, if you know?
He was 5'10".
But, man, he always – I mean, he's a great – he had a great press attaché, but he always projects himself as this giant.
Yeah, well, he always stood very erect, kept himself in reasonably good shape, and he always – you see the picture of MacArthur and the emperor. You know, the emperor's maybe 5 feet tall, and MacArthur's a good – almost a foot taller than him. So I think that just told the Japanese people that the Americans were in charge. And this guy MacArthur was on the same level, if not superior, to the emperor.
So Hirohito, Rick Bigelow, we got to take a break, but he renounced his divinity. He had been a god, maybe small g, but for many Japanese, a big G in the word god. He renounces his divinity, and he calls on MacArthur at the U.S. Embassy in Tokyo, September 27th, 1945. We'll pick it up from there with Rick Bigelow. MacArthur is the subject. We'll take a break and be back. Rick Bigelow is with us. MacArthur is the subject. You mentioned food issues, and things were desperate. And MacArthur had a lot to do there, didn't he?
He did. You know, the naval blockade that the U.S. and the British put on Japan was very effective. And of course, Japan had relied on importing a lot of food during the war years. And as the naval blockade took effect, that meant that Japan was slowly starving and there was food rationing. there was a raging black market for food, and MacArthur told the U.S. government, I need 3.5 million tons of food as soon as possible. He said, if you don't give me the food, there's going to be a riot, a nationwide riot. So the U.S. government, along with doing everything in Europe, gave MacArthur a lot of food. So that kind of put the bad situation to rest for a while. He also allowed farmers to buy land from the large landowners. And, of course, this the individual farmers was to their benefit to make a lot of food. So by 1949, the food crisis was over.
Now, one of the things, Rick Bigelow, you mentioned is the GIs were instructed not to take food from the Japanese. How large, approximately, was our occupying force?
This is an amazing story. We thought it was going to take a million troops to put down the Japanese and to occupy. MacArthur, when he got there, said, no, I only need 500,000. And within a few months, he said, I only need 250,000. And after a while, it got down to about 100,000 troops in Japan. And it's mainly because the emperor said, you know, listen to the Americans. They're in charge. And the troops took a very non-militaristic view of things. You know, they didn't have large-scale maneuvers or parades or anything like that. They were there, but they were in the background. So that was another really good thing he did during the occupation. I think the biggest thing was the Constitution. He wanted a new Constitution, and he told the Japanese Parliament, come up with a new Constitution. So they came up with a new Constitution. He read it and said, not good enough. And so he got his staff, which was a lot of whom were from his Bataan staff, in the Philippines and Australia and New Guinea. He got them together and said, I need a new constitution in a week. So they put their heads down, wrote up a new constitution. He gave it to the Japanese parliament and said, approve this. And they did. Mm-hmm. That constitution has stayed in effect and has never been amended. It's been in effect for 79 years.
Amazing. We've got to take a break. Rick Bigelow is our guest. He is, especially, we got to let you take care of your cough, too. So we'll take a break. We'll come back, hear from our great sponsors, our veterans tribute to Gene Ogozalek and the weather, and then more Rick Bigelow and MacArthur after this. Rick Bigelow is our guest, and he is telling us about MacArthur and all of that. We're at the point, Rick Bigelow, where we put in a new constitution. I mean, isn't it remarkable? I mean, he really followed the American model, did he not?
Yeah, he did. And actually, his staff went and got copies of every constitution they could find, and they picked out the best parts of it. A lot of it was U.S., but you know, some from the British system. They made a parliamentary form of government based on the British system. They took the best of a lot of different constitutions, and especially the rights of women and labor unions and so on and so forth. So they did it in a week, and it was rather remarkable.
Yeah.
And it stayed in shape ever since then.
Well, there was a pretty good template in place.
Yeah.
Now, one of the biggest things in my mind was that they instituted land reform. They didn't take the land, however, from the nobility and the wealthy families. They had these former serfs, essentially, buy the land. And I thought that was a fascinating and actually brilliant move.
I agree. And what they didn't realize when the landowners agreed to this was that the farmers had a lot of money, because they'd made a lot of money on the black market, selling food, because they were secretly developing more food and selling it to people that lived in the cities. So they had the money to buy land from the rich landowners, which they did. So, but that was a stroke of genius on MacArthur's part, without a doubt.
Well, he had land reform, labor reform, political reform, education reform, which is important. We're seeing the negative effects of the education system in this country, and he saw the same thing there. They needed to get rid of the militaristic anti-Western curriculum, and he did it.
That's right. And they made it more focused on democratic principles, which was to the benefit of the people for the most part.
But I look through these summaries and the bullet points, Rick Bigelow, and I just say to myself, this is brilliance.
Yes. And I think, you know, he had a great career as a general, as a military officer. I think this was his finest hour.
Yeah.
Up until the Korean War.
yeah.
And then it kind of got away from him. But he did a masterful job. He had 5 million Japanese troops that had to be brought home. And most of them were brought home by 1948, except those that were captured by the Russians in Manchuria. Only about a third of them, actually two-thirds of them, made it back, but several hundred thousand kind of died in the gulags in Siberia.
I mean, 2.6 million soldiers in China.
Right.
1.1 million in Manchuria. 500,000 in Formosa, now Taiwan. 900,000 in Korea, 900,000 spread throughout Southeast Asia and the Philippines, 500,000 in New Guinea and various islands in the Pacific. I mean, and you're bringing back, you got to create jobs, you've got to have food, you've got to have opportunities and social life and outlets for all of these young military men. Wow.
Well, not only that, but a lot of them were coming home to cities that had been destroyed.
Yeah.
Their homes had been destroyed. Their families were gone. So that was a big problem. And I don't want to say everything was perfect in post-war Japan, but a lot of the things he did led to them becoming a very prosperous nation, which they certainly are today.
Now, there were reverse repatriations. Our soldiers and our allies had to be returned home.
Right. Something like 31,000 U.S. and British Commonwealth POWs and 900,000 Koreans returned home. So this was a massive logistics effort, not only to bring the Japanese soldiers back to Japan to help rebuild the country, but also to get the U.S. and Commonwealth POWs and the Koreans back home. It was a massive effort. And, of course, most of it had to be done by ship.
Yeah.
Because everything had to cross the oceans to get these people back to Japan or get them back home.
Rick Bigelow, somebody texted in. They said, could you imagine if today's State Department was in charge of all this? it merits nothing but a guffaw.
Well, this is an interesting point. MacArthur was supposedly overseen by a multinational group, British, French, Dutch, Australian, and also a U.S. group that was supposed to monitor what he was doing. He kind of ignored them, which is, classic MacArthur. They were having all these meetings and making all these recommendations, and he never went to any of the meetings. He always sent his underlings, and very rarely did he ever do what they suggested. He knew what he wanted to do.
And if they came up with a good idea, he took credit for it anyway.
Yeah, or he would say, I've already done that.
Yeah, yeah. All right, we've got to take a break, Rick Bigelow. Let's get – so he does an amazing job, which we could talk about forever, in Japan. And then Korean War breaks out. We're going to go to that when we come back. Rick Bigelow is our guest. MacArthur is our subject. And I want to ask you, Rick, quickly. I thought American Caesar was one of the best accounts of General Douglas MacArthur in his life.
I agree. That was Manchester's book.
Yes.
Manchester. Very good summary of what happened. He left a few things out.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And the amazing thing is, Manchester was a Marine.
It was almost sanitized a bit, but it gave you all the bullet points, and you're doing even better than that here. So Rick Bigelow's our guest, MacArthur the subject. We'll take a break. We'll be back. Rick Bigelow's our guest. Rick, there'll never be enough time to go through all this, but we got about 5-6 minutes, but North Korea attacks across the 38th parallel on June 24th, 1950. MacArthur is still the governor of Japan, and he's called upon for a new role.
Right. He's called upon to be head of the United Nations Command in Korea. And frankly, the U.S. troops in Japan, and there were, 50 to 100,000 U.S. troops there, they weren't ready. And MacArthur just kind of disregarded intelligence warnings about North Korean buildup along the 38th parallel. And he just didn't think they would do it. And, when they came across, it was a total shock to him. So the North Koreans push us all the way down to what's known as the Pusan perimeter, which is about a 50-mile perimeter around the southeastern port of Pusan in Korea. And we were hanging on by our fingernails there. And MacArthur comes up with the Incheon landing, which is 30 miles west of Seoul.
And go behind enemy lines, loop around and go behind. Brilliant tactically.
Right. But he'd been doing it in New Guinea, and he did it again in the Philippines. And so, he had the right idea. And so the Incheon landing turns the whole thing around. The North Koreans withdraw. They go back up into North Korea. We go over the 38th parallel way up into North Korea. And once again, MacArthur and his staff disregard indications that the Chinese are going to enter the war, and he wants to push all the way to the Yalu River, and he's promising that the troops will be home by Christmas, back to the United States by Christmas, and then the Chinese enter the war with somewhere between 600,000 and a million troops and turn the whole thing around.
And they rout us. All right, so yeah. Rick Bigelow, someone had texted in about this, but it's an interesting question. From your view, MacArthur wanted to go all out and use atomic and nuclear weapons against China. Have you ever gamed that out in your mind? And I've read a decent amount of what the results could have been. Some people speculate we would have never had a Vietnam and really a lot of other wishful thinking if we had followed MacArthur's prescriptions. How might that have changed everything, history?
Well, you got to remember that the Russians exploded their own atomic bomb in 1949.
Yep,
and they would have never not responded to an atomic bombing in China. So I think it would have just opened up a whole new atomic war. I think it would have been a disaster if we did it.
Yeah,
and I think MacArthur was he was vehemently against the communists, and he wanted to take Mao Zedong and the Communist Party out and let Chiang Kai-shek.
He had a relationship with Chiang Kai-shek?
He did. He did. In fact, after he retired from the army in the mid 30s, Chiang Kai-shek wanted him to go to China to build up their army. And maybe things would have been different if he had done that. So who knows what would have happened, but I think Harry Truman did the right thing to fire him. Because he was just getting way too bellicose. And I think he was personally affronted that the Chinese had entered the war because he didn't think they would. And, of course, he was always right. And so, you know, how dare they show that he was wrong? And so I think he was a little bit out to lunch on that one, I think.
So MacArthur or Truman has to fire him. And it was gutsy politically. I mean, big time gutsy. Heading into an election year. And this guy is, you know, beyond popular in the United States. His errors were never really publicized. And the little guy sticks it to him and says, you are not following the chain of command. You're gone.
Exactly. Yeah. As MacArthur himself said once upon a time, I have to hand it to him. Little SOB had the guts to fire me. So MacArthur leaves Japan as a hero. When he had a long motorcade to the airport when he was fired, and millions of Japanese lined the streets to wish him farewell, he was second only to the emperor in the minds of the Japanese at the time. And there were all kinds of plans to make all kinds of memorials to MacArthur in Japan and so on and so forth. So MacArthur gets back to the United States, and he has this nationwide tour and, you know, thunderous crowds and all kinds of accolades and so on and so forth. So he goes to Congress, and he testifies before Congress, and he blows it. He talks about, you know, rebuilding Germany and rebuilding Japan, and he makes a statement. It says, whereas the Germans as a nation are fully mature, the Japanese are adolescents.
There goes their hero.
The same type of guffaw, you know, calling New Guineans cannibals.
So he has an ignominious end in Japan and, of course, in America. Rick Bigelow, Thank you so much for following up on this MacArthur. We look forward to your next essay with us.
Glad to do it, Bob.
All right. Rick Bigelow, MacArthur, they go together. We'll be back.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
All-star closer Kenley Jansen, we have a question.
What's the best podcast of all time? Baseball isn't boring, baby.
I'm Rob Bradford, and every single day I'm sitting down with the biggest names to show you this great game is the greatest game. It's my podcast. It's my passion. It's a cause I started more than 2 years ago and is now the most prolific national daily baseball pod there is. Another fact, so jump aboard the BIB Express. Follow and listen to Baseball Isn't Boring, presented by Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.